Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. This episode of the show is done with Kevin Cole, who is the Director of Analytics at rotogrinders.com. We have a pretty fascinating discussion about how we came to discover sports analytics, our combined passion for both the NBA and the NFL, of course, inefficiencies in the NFL draft and roster construction, and a lot more, even some discussion of how to attack showdown slates on DraftKings and the math behind that. Really an interesting conversation with Kevin. Please make sure if you enjoy the podcast to rate and review on iTunes. You have no idea how much it helps. It's absolutely massive, so please do that if you're enjoying the show. Feel free to email me, davismatic@gmail.com, with any suggestions you have for the show, any comments, complaints, suggestions for guests. I'm really wide open to talking about the format of the show and what you guys want to hear. And without any further ado, we'll go ahead and get into the interview. Hello, everyone. I would like to welcome Kevin Cole, Kev Cole on Twitter, to the podcast. He is the Director of Analytics at rotogrinders.com and also, I believe, a contributor to the newly restructured fantasyinsiders.com. Kev, how are you doing, pal?
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be on the podcast. I've been a big fan so far. I really like what you're doing here, and you talk to some interesting people, and you get into some subjects that are a little bit off of the normal football, sports, fantasy path, so that's always good.
You were a listener recommendation, first time listener recommendation to the show. So yeah, if this goes well, maybe I'll open it up. Maybe some more listener recommendations can come on.
You should have listeners actually conduct the interviews for you also and then just send it to you. Then you don't have to do anything.
Then I wouldn't have to do it. All I would have to do would be maintain the Podomatic feed, which is really ideal for me. If I could somehow farm out the interviewing to someone else, that's ideal for me.
Because that's what it's all about.
Yeah. So the first question that I want to get into is, you are pretty obviously an actual smart guy first as opposed to a sports guy first. I think there's a really interesting distinction in fantasy Twitter where you can kind of tell when it's people who, you know, really fell in love with sports and then found out a way to really understand them. Like, I would consider a lot of the football scouting guys to be football guys first who found a way to interpret their love of the game with numbers. But I think my interpretation of your work is that you were a smart guy first. You were a numbers guy, analytics guy first, who saw an avenue with sports. So first, I want you to tell me if that's true. And then second of all, I want you to tell me how you found your way to our little corner of the internet.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to figure out exactly what the path is. I mean, I've always been a sports fan. I'm not obsessed with sports. I think there's also another category of people, at least in the world of DFS in particular, and those are people who just, you know, like gambling, essentially.
Yes.
Who then get into it as an avenue of being able to do that. So I probably don't really fall. I'm not a sports nut per se, but I definitely like sports a lot. I'm definitely don't fall on the spectrum as being a huge gambler. I mean, I've done gambling throughout my life, but it wouldn't be the biggest thing. I think the biggest thing has been just answering questions, and I worked in finance for quite a while where I wasn't really doing the type of programming and modeling that I'm doing now. So, I mean, I like the finance. I like some of those sorts of questions, but getting into sports, I think it's a lot better because there are such strong narratives in sports that it provides a lot of value when you're able to dig through those and kind of combat some of the biases that you see in sports. And it's probably a lot more biased than something like finance, where it's extremely difficult to beat people who are really doing a good job as far as valuing companies.
So you're like a game theory guy. You're more, yes, of like a systems guy. Like, you just are interested in figuring out how systems work and how to beat the systems.
Yeah, so I mean, with an interest in sports also. So the two things kind of go hand in hand.
What was your first sport that you fell in love with? Do you have a memory of being like, wow, this is fascinating to watch. I'm really into this.
I mean, I don't know if it was a moment like that. I mean, my dad was a big Lakers fan. I'm from Southern California, which I always have to tell people when I tell people I'm a Lakers fan, or else,
yes,
you know, they can rightfully trash me for that. You know, you don't want to be one of those guys who's like a Cowboys, Yankees, Lakers fan type of guy. So growing up,
like,
Southern California,
like LeBron is, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. So I was a big Lakers fan growing up. My dad's not that into baseball, so I got into baseball for a little while. And because he's not into baseball and I wasn't into the local team, I kind of did what kids do, which is you start rooting for a team who was playing well when I was extremely young. Now I'm a bit older than you are, so you may not remember, but back in like the Bash Brothers, Ricky Henderson sort of days for the A's,
the A's used to be great.
I mean, they were the best team in baseball. I think they won a chance. They should have won a lot more than they did, but obviously baseball is a very random sport in the playoffs. So I started to get into baseball that way. It was never really into hockey, not a California thing. And then football, my dad was a Raiders fan from when their stint in LA. So I definitely followed all those things growing up. So I wouldn't say there's like one moment. I'd say it was just, I was pretty well aligned with what my dad was, and basketball and the Lakers being the biggest thing.
I wonder how many people do just tail their dads, because like that's what I did. Like, I root for all the same teams that my dad does. Like, those are the only things I care about in terms of like outcomes for sporting games. And my first memories were of watching the 2001 Stanley Cup Finals when the Avalanche won in seven games. That was like memory number one. And then memory number two is the Josh Heupel national championship win against Florida State, where they won 13-2 against Chris Winkie. And those were like the two times where I was like, wow, this is really what I want to do. Like, I love this. I'm really interested in this. But I actually wonder how many guys just get it from their dads.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's either you get it from your parent or you just seek out the best team that's currently playing right now. Because I think it's pretty rare that someone's going to root for the home team if they stink, if your parents aren't into it, if your family's not into it. It just seems kind of torturous to do something like that. Maybe if you have friends and some other people who are into it. But now that you mentioned, I remember there was one particular Lakers moment where I can't remember the year, but it was during one of their title runs in the early 2000s, where Game 7 against the Portland Trail Blazers is a pretty famous play where Kobe kind of crosses up, I think it's Pippen who's guarding him at the top, and then he throws the alley-oop to Shaq. And I remember being with my dad and just going just fucking crazy when that happened. So yeah, moments like that, you know, they can't be replicated, obviously, when you're talking about getting outside of sports and some other things.
So that was a more emotional conversation, but I do want to start to get into some nuts and bolts. So the second episode of this show had my friend / enemy, my frenemy, Josh Hermsmeyer on the show. We actually agree on most things other than Bitcoin, which we'll talk about later in this episode. But we both agreed that the Browns should have taken quarterbacks 1 and 4. We both agreed Baker was the guy. And then I think I liked Rosen with the fourth, and I think maybe he wanted Darnold. I don't remember the exact specifics, but the thing we disagreed on was he said, regardless of who you choose, whether it be Baker or QB number two, you could probably trade the guy you didn't want to start for close to value, you know, a second round pick or a guy on a good contract you could start right away. And I kind of think the way that NFL teams work is once you decide someone's not good enough for your organization, it's really hard to sell someone as being good enough for another organization. So I wanted to see where you weighed in on that, because I think it's a really interesting football conversation that touches on a lot of the inefficiencies of the game right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with both of you that it's a sound strategy. I mean, just to get a look at a couple of different guys, You really, I mean, obviously we don't know much about quarterback prospects coming out, football prospect generally. You look at the hit rates, they're abysmal, even for guys who are at the top of the draft. So getting a couple of looks is good, but, you know, being able to retain the value, I'm kind of with you on that one. I just don't think it's really possible. I mean, you have, first off, you're taking a guy at four. So you let's say you're playing out the draft like it did last year. I mean, Darnold's gone, right? So you're taking, if you take Rosen at four, you know, he didn't go till 10. So mm-hmm. He's already not really that favorite of a prospect. So you're already figuring there's all these teams who passed on him who weren't willing to take him in the top 10. So to say that you're going to retain, even at that moment, you couldn't get the value on him. Now you go into the next year, it's someone, like you're saying, it's someone who's going to lose a quarterback battle. So it's probably unlikely that they look great in preseason or whatever action they get. They're also going to be worse than Baker Mayfield. So then again, if people favored him but didn't favor Baker Mayfield, are they still going to favor him if right. he's objectively worse than Baker Mayfield now? It just seems very unlikely. I think the key when it comes to a lot of these decisions, and it's also one of the keys when you're thinking about going for both these guys, is just, you know, you got to cut your losses quickly and move on and not worry about the sunk cost that goes into these decisions. So I wouldn't be so worried about retaining value on it as opposed to getting double the shot of being able to look at these guys. I think you learn infinitely more about them once they're in an NFL system than you do when they're a prospect.
The reason that I started thinking about this overall is that you never see this happen in the NFL, but in the NBA, you see guys get drafted and then traded, you know, when they're eligible to be traded. And what you will find out is that the pick is infinitely more valuable than the player. Like a first round pick, the going rate for a first round pick is huge. It's like, to get a first round pick, you have to take on a shit ton of dead money. You have to do something amazing to get a first round pick. But to get, I don't know who's the eighth overall pick this year, whoever it was, you could trade for him or get rid of him for a much lower amount, and you get much less in a trade for a rookie player. And so it's kind of like the fallacy of you being better at decision making than everyone else. And I think just because there is not an example of that in the NFL, it's not as entrenched with the idea that a player on the roster instantly loses their value. But a player in the draft is like a used car. The second the sticker comes off, they lose a good chunk of their value.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, unless you have something where you're getting some information that makes them look better. I mean, I remember Mike Lombardi tweeted out about, you know, he doesn't like Mayfield, right? So he had some bullshit reasoning about, well, think if you tried to trade Mayfield now, you couldn't get the first pick for him. I was like, well, no shit, you can't get the first pick for him. I mean, you're only getting, because once you draft a player, you're drafting a player. You trade a pick, you're getting the right to draft any player that you wanted to draft. So obviously it's going to be a lot more valuable. And I think there may be some confusion when it comes to people like, you know, Pat Mahomes is somebody where you could trade him for more than the 10th overall pick that you paid for.
Yeah, so Mahomes has, his value has appreciated significantly the same way that, like, you know, 3 months from now, Luka Doncic, you couldn't just get him for a first round pick. Like, his value will appreciate significantly. But on the converse, like Ben McLemore was, I think, the 7th overall pick and has now been traded as cap filler 40 times.
Yeah, but I mean, I think for Mahomes, it's mostly just teams recognize now that they fucked up on their evaluation.
Sure.
And that he's looked good and they've heard all this buzz. And in particular, the fact that they jettisoned Alex Smith, who had, you know, kind of like it's shocking to say, but his numbers were almost like MVP adjacent. I wouldn't say MVP.
No, he was great. You could say MVP adjacent. He was great last year. He was one of the five best players in the league last
Although
year.
I have to say, one of the few times I've ever been ratioed is when I suggested to get rid of Alex. I mean, you never think there'd be Alex Smith stands that would come out of nowhere,
dude,
but
they're all over the, I mean, I'm kind of one of them.
Well, I said that they should put in Mahomes at the end of last year just to give him a chance to win. Sure. And of course everyone was like, you know, their defense, he doesn't play defense. I agree with all that stuff, but there's a reason Mahomes didn't play last year, but all the buzz has been great about him. So yeah, you'd have to have one of those situations, but I think those situations are unique. It's not like there's a lot of players who you're going to draft and not play, and there's going to be positive buzz about them at the same time in the NFL. That just doesn't make sense. Quarterbacks, if they look good, they should be starting quickly, if not immediately, unless they have a very good option in front of them, or the team is so good that they just don't lose games. I mean, I've kind of gone back and forth on Tyrod Taylor and Mayfield this year, what it means for Mayfield if he doesn't start. At first I thought it wasn't a big deal if he didn't start, because I like Tyrod. I think he's a great player. But the thing is, the Browns are going to lose games. So no matter how well Tyrod plays. They're not going to be, you know, like Alex Smith and the Chiefs starting off last season. So if Baker doesn't play fairly early, I guess I'd be somewhat surprised, even if Tyrod's doing well, because people hate Tyrod and they're going to lose games, basically.
I am team Tyrod is actually not that good. Like, I know that's not a popular take with stats people. Like, analytics people are like, you know, Tyrod's good. He does all these things and aren't bleep blah blue. I just don't think that the sort of football that you have to play around him is generally like aggressive, good, winning football. And I don't even know if it's necessarily his issue. Like, I even kind of think that a very cool thing that would happen would be a quarterback rotation. It'll never work just because of the structure of the NFL, and guys would just bristle against it so hard. But I mean, I think kind of that this neck, maybe three waves from now in the NFL, quarterback rotations can work. The big reason it couldn't work right now is just quarterback contracts are so disproportionate to everyone else on the roster that you couldn't pay two guys who can play. Is that a ludicrous, like, just lunacy idea, or is that something that, like, you could see being viable as like an analytic strategy 15 years from now?
Oh, I could totally see it being viable. In fact, I mean, it kind of harkens back. I don't know if you remember
Pat White.
Fantasy Douche and his YOLO QB strategy, which is basically get a whole bunch of replaceable running sort of quarterbacks.
Yeah, you get three running quarterbacks, and when one gets hurt, you just put the other one in.
Just put the other one in. I had, this will go down as one of the worst like headlines of all time, although Mariota's not playing so much anymore. This is back when Chip Kelly, there was all these rumors that he was going to trade up to get Marcus Mariota, and I said, instead of Mariota, like, go get – you know, they still. Prior. I think they actually had like Tebow, Johnny Manziel, and maybe keep a guy who you could play, and then have Tebow be your short yardage quarterback. Mm-hmm. Manziel, maybe your kind of like neutral situation, and then get another guy who you want to throw the ball when you're in really long situation, and do some sort of rotation. I totally think that can work. The problem is if any of them sees any sort of success, they're going to want to get paid. They're going to want to play a lot more downs. You're going to have to be comfortable letting guys go who have played well and who may be good. So you're just setting yourself up to get fired, basically. I mean, but it might not be the worst strategy, but I think at some point you might have to say, we're going to commit to somebody. But it gives you more looks at guys at the very least.
So a thing that I've also been realizing is that there are no small market NFL teams. Like, this is something you will constantly hear when you listen to NBA and MLB analysis, is like, oh, well, this is a small market NBA team, so they should pursue this strategy based on analytics because this works with their salary cap situation. Or you'll hear, you know, this MLB team's really investing in its pitching staff and teaching all of their pitchers to pitch this way because it works with their financial restraints. But that doesn't exist in the NFL. So no team is going to be incentivized to try something truly radical just based off of money constraints, because every NFL team is worth so much and generates so much income, they can pay any contract they want. And, you know, a lot of NFL capologists will talk about dead money and this and that. I mean, can you remember the last NFL team that had a serious salary crunch that really made the product worse on field? Like, Dallas has this horrible, terrible capped out situation. They always find a way to pay guys if they want to. Like, they could have paid Dez Bryant. They just didn't want to. Like, they're still paying Tony Romo. I don't ever see the cap really killing a team on the field unless I'm just uneducated.
Yeah, I don't think it kills the team. I think it just makes things difficult. I mean, you've seen the Saints and other people have been able to work around it. I mean, they got bailed out with a lot of good draft picks. So, I mean, I agree. I think there are two fundamental things about football. Free agency is just non-existent, right? So you don't have to worry about players leaving for other teams. I think there's, number one, there's not a marketability to the player outside of like the team and the NFL, other than maybe a few quarterbacks. I don't think it's the same thing as it is in the NBA where you have superstars. And number two, the franchise tag is just enormous. I don't know why there should be more of a focus for players and for the union of getting rid of the franchise tag. That holds down players' salaries at the top end, which then filters down to everyone else, and it limits their ability to move. So, yeah, small market teams can retain their talent, because when you say to someone, we're going to force you to play on a one-year contract in football, nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to do that. So they're willing to re-sign at a lower amount. So there aren't the same strategies, because there aren't the same concerns about talent leaving as there are in other sports with free agency and with no franchise tag.
Yeah, I do want to get back to the YOLO QB thing, because like that's just been my belief about football for so long. Like, if you go look in my RotoViz archive, I'm standing for every running quarterback there is: Kaepernick, Tebow, Pryor, Tyrod. It doesn't matter. I've stand for all of them. And teams have done like partial QB rotation before, like Kurt Warner was in one, you know, quite some time ago. And even before my time of watching football, I've heard rumors that there was like a team that had a red zone quarterback. I think maybe it was like the Giants in the 80s or something. And I think what you would have to have as an organization to implement that is complete synergy from the owner down to the offensive coordinator in every step of the way. And you would have to just accept like, okay, we drafted Zach Desert, you know, in the fifth round, and he's like this total immobile bad quarterback, but we repeatedly put him in situations where all we needed him to do was throw this ball 35 yards and he made the throw. So he gets a contract from somewhere else and you just have to let him go. And the owner and the GM and the coach and the coordinators all have to be on board with that. Because I think you could make some of these like immobile, stocky Big Ten quarterbacks, like legit NFL quarterbacks, if all they were asked to do was throw on third down.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that. And I also think the secondary market, I mean, you probably don't think, I mean, you say you're not high on Tyrod, but his contract is not that bad.
Probably the Tyrod contract is fine. I just think that Baker clearly has like Super Bowl winning quarterback MVP caliber sort of numbers in him, and I know for a fact Tyrod does not.
I'm just saying, in a vacuum, I think Tyrod fits into this sort of theory.
Yeah, so he does fit in the theory, but not as like a full time. This is the guy you need down 10 points in the fourth quarter.
I mean, I just think you want to get a lot of looks. So I don't know if you want to necessarily use a lot of draft picks. I mean, maybe you could use a lot of late round draft picks, but you can also pick guys up who are just not thriving someplace else because they don't fit the mold and they're just sitting on the bench, and just start throwing out very late round picks, things like that, to grab guys who may be on rosters elsewhere and things like that too. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talent that you can go and find out there. It's just the sustainability of that sort of strategy is you're going to have to hit some picks elsewhere to have a good defense, basically.
So do you watch any level of football other than the NFL? Do you watch CFL or college football or anything?
I don't watch CFL. I'm somewhat into college football. I mean, my interest in college football is primarily tied to watching quarterback prospects.
Yeah, draft picks.
Or something like that, yeah.
So this is actually a reasonable question then, because I kind of think like the guys who play for like Washington State, like the guys who throw like 75 pass attempts a game, they never go anywhere in the NFL. Like Luke Falk, he's like a backup for some, or third string for someone. And then the other guy is like the Georgia Tech quarterbacks, like the triple option quarterbacks. A lot of those guys go to the CFL, like Nick Arbuckle is in the CFL. And those are the type of guys you don't have to spend any draft capital on. You can get those guys as undrafted free agents. And I just think like if there was a 33rd NFL team, I would love to see them just roll with like one of the Washington State guys, one triple option guy, and then one like Big 12 air raid guy, and just kind of deploy them situationally. Like, I think that would be the most fun I've had watching football my whole life.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to also use systems like they're using there. I think that's the important part. I mean, I think everyone wants to have a quarterback who can just beat an NFL defense, especially in these, you know, third and long and those sort of situations. I mean, I just don't think it's as important to get that prototypical pocket passer guy. I think you run a system which is simplified. You run a system that maximizes talent, but maybe doesn't give you the same sort of ceiling. And then you just cycle through these guys. And so not only do you have guys who pass it a bunch, but you have guys who run it. And you kind of use both of those things. You raise the floor so high from an offensive perspective that you can build around that and really build a successful team without having to say, we're just going to continue to play craps and hope we get this one quarterback who's extremely rare, who can end up being that prototypical franchise quarterback type.
So a point that Dan Orlovsky made on the last episode of this podcast was kind of a concern he has about the Browns is that Tyrod and Baker are like really couldn't be more different as quarterbacks. Baker really needs, you know, spread offenses, probably four wide receiver sets more often, like needs motion, and Tyrod is much better the other way, like in like 12 personnel, two tight ends, you know, kind of stable, kind of similar and consistent play calling down after down. Would you have a concern? Is that a legitimate concern you would have for Baker's development? That's kind of why I think Baker should just start from game one so that the offense could be tailor-made to what he does well.
I would be against Baker starting from game one. I mean, I don't know what Hugh Jackson's going to do. I'm not an expert. He didn't seem to do a very good job last year making things easier for DeShone Kizer, so I don't know what...
Yeah, Hugh is like a giant fish, and it really, that could like ruin Sashi's legacy, as he gets all these great players, they have all this draft capital, and then Hugh Jackson just diarrheas all over it.
I mean, as long as... Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with Baker. I think there's a pretty credible argument that Sashi would have taken Baker also, but it might
definitely
be. So I don't know if it'd be a Sam. It's not gonna be a Sam Hinkie type of situation where people are really dedicated to him. But getting back to the two different quarterbacks, I mean, I can't assess any of those things. So I always feel like when you don't know whether or not these development questions matter, I'm always gonna err on the side of thinking that we probably overvalue the narrative of things like development, and we undervalue someone's just good, and they're going to be, they're going to play well, whether they're not developed properly or not. I mean, that's another question that even goes into quarterbacks. There was a discussion about whether you should play early or not, whether it hurts your development to play or not to play. I think in most situations is guys who play earlier, they do better because they're playing earlier because they're good. And so everything kind of boils down to a guy being good or not. At the end. But clearly there's effects that come into play with, you know, scheming and play calling and all that sort of stuff, but we probably overvalue it.
So in European soccer, there's been a lot of studies kind of on what you should do with young players, because there's this scenario where basically all of the big teams, all of the top really good teams, it's hard for them to get young players into their team just because the stakes are so high. And, you know, in a Champions League final or even in a Champions League knockout game, you can't really bring in an 18-year-old just to get him experience, because the value of these games is not in the millions, it's in the billions to, like, advance further in these competitions. It makes or breaks people's entire careers. And so there's a system where guys get loaned out, where they go play for like slightly smaller clubs. But all of the research says, you know, the younger a guy is able to get in a competitive match where the stakes matter, like the higher his output will be for the rest of his career. And so I'm definitely team get the guys starting immediately. Like, if you think he has the potential to be the answer, you should just get him in. And that should be the answer at every position. And I don't even get a sense of how, like, a lot of the times you see it with wide receivers, like they're kind of redshirted that rookie year, and that can't be good for their development, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it in terms of near the end of the season, once you've been eliminated from playoff contention, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't just be getting looks to everybody, basically. Just get these guys out there. I mean, even from a trade value perspective, I mean, think about it. When someone like Jimmy G went out there and looked good for two games, everyone was going nuts. So maybe you could even play this kind of overconfidence thing, and you could put a backup quarterback out there. What if he plays well for two games? You might have a trade chip that you can throw out there. The problem is in the NFL, I'm sure there'd be huge blowback about the fact that if you're playing against other teams who are in playoff contention, that you're not fielding the best roster, so therefore you're hurting the competitiveness of the league and this and that. But I think from purely selfish perspective, once you're eliminated from playoff contention, you should just be playing your backups all the time to get a look at them for yourself, and then also for trade value. The league probably would frown upon that, though.
So before we move on to some other kind of interesting stuff, I do want to get a sense from you. Where are you at in terms of talent evaluation in the NFL draft? Are you off the height, weight, speed train? Like Josh is definitely, like, you know, he's a fade the combine guy. We talked about that. Do you try and learn a lot from production, or are you just kind of the NFL draft school that it's literally next to impossible to tell, so you should just amass as many draft picks and get as many new guys on the roster as you can?
Well, I mean, I think the last thing is probably the most important.
I think we all agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of something we all agree with. Now, I think draft position, whatever that entails, I mean, it's mostly scouting, is still going to be the most important thing
indicator
at a prospect. I mean, it's extremely difficult to separate opportunity from skill. I mean, especially something like quarterback, where literally one player will take every single snap for an entire season at the position. I mean, how is a guy who's drafted late going to even get a chance? So it's tough to separate those things. But I mean, generally, those players are going to be better than not. I'm a little bit different than he is on the combine, only because I don't see the game speed stuff as being particularly useful. I mean, I know that he's shown some year-over-year correlations. But, I do like the fact when you're looking at a variable, you say, how independent is it of everything else? So at least for the combine, I think assessing someone's speed, you really are getting a good measure of how fast someone is when you strip everything down and you just have them run a completely, isolated 40-yard dash. I think you are getting a good estimate of someone's speed is. Now, it just depends on whether we're overvaluing it or not, and that definitely may be the case. But at least you're getting a very independent assessment, which is difficult to get in other aspects of football. So I think the combine is important, probably more important for someone like a running back than it is for other positions. But production is always going to be the one thing that's going to be all – when you're holding all else equal, it's the one thing that clearly is going to be undervalued the most. And I think the work that PFF and others have done, where for a lot of positions you don't have a good production metric,
yeah.
Or you have a very noisy thing like sacks or something like that, where if you can break down on a play-by-play basis, whether it's a successful play or an unsuccessful play, things like that, and then track all that over time, that would be where you're going to get the biggest advantage over anything else and the biggest advantage over traditional analysts who are just looking at it from a scouting perspective.
Hey everyone, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about Apex Fantasy Leagues, the best place to play online season-long fantasy football for money. There is a skill-based format where you play two games per week, and there's industry-leading payouts where Apex actually adds money to the payout pool. They really ensure that the best fantasy players get the good return on their investment. Apex hosts 12-team PPR leagues that provide a variety of drafting options, live or email, snake draft or auction. You also have the flexibility to sign up for a league just hours before the draft. On top of that, Apex pretty often puts extra money from their profits into the prize pool to make sure that leagues get filled. Apex also offers dynasty leagues in a variety of formats. And finally, Apex is the place to play if you want to win big money in a format that mitigates randomness. Not only does Apex have the highest payouts in the whole industry on a percentage basis, but it also features both blind bidding, free agent acquisition budgets, so that all free agent acquisitions are fair in two matchups per week, one versus a head-to-head opponent and the other versus the league average, so that you don't get screwed when your opponent has the most points and you have the second most points. You're still going to come out of that week with a win. You can compete every week without worrying about arbitrary strength of schedule. Give it a try. I promise you will love it. Go to apexfantasyleagues.com today and sign up. And now let's get back to the show. There we go. So transitioning now, a lot of football guys, they don't really pay attention and definitely don't understand the game of basketball. I guess we kind of already talked about where your passion for the game came from, but I want your thoughts on the evolution of basketball, because I think those are some of the most interesting conversations I've had on this podcast, is talking with people about where the game goes from, space the floor, shoot threes, don't pay a center, everyone's 6'8", plays the same way. Because I kind of just think that sort of the homogenization is either going to make the game really boring or someone's going to start doing something different. One of those two things has to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest question for me for what's happening with the game is, I mean, number one, I think looking at basketball is great for football and other sports, because there's so many things. I would say the 3-point versus 2-point debate is probably the most similar thing in football to the pass run debate, where, over time you just want to do the higher
gain more yards.
Yeah. You want to do doing the higher variance, lower success rate thing is still better if the upside is so much greater, which it is like in passing or shooting the three. So I think the NBA has gone pretty far in that direction. Obviously the Rockets embodying going for super high variance and then also going for this replaceability and switching. What I'm most interested to see is with the NBA is with the big men. I think you saw in particular in this draft class that came out that you have guys who could kind of do everything The three-point, I mean, you see the three-point shooting, maybe not they were doing it in college, but they're working on it a lot, and it's something that they're going to be bringing into their game, whether it's Bamba or Jaren Jackson.
Mo Bamba would have been, like, the draft prospect of the millennium had he been in college 10 years ago. Like, there, you would not have been able to escape this dude, this, like, 7'1 guy who can, like, move and shoot and dribble. Like, you would have never stopped hearing about him.
Yeah, so I think offensively, these guys are going to fit into the new NBA. There's not going to be a problem there at all. Defensively, they're going to be rim protectors. But the problem is, I don't know with switching. And I think switching and the ability of everyone to play against a team like the Warriors, I mean, maybe the Warriors won't be there again. But if you, but then, and again, if you look at the Rockets, the Celtics, all these teams are kind of doing something similar. So I don't know whether they can work on that, because that's not a skill that you can work on, like shooting a three-pointer. Guys who are 7 feet tall just might not have the physical ability to switch and to do things like that. I mean, Embiid got run off the court, essentially, in that Celtics series, where he wasn't very effective switching on the defensive end, even though generally he's a great defender, but against some of these other teams, he may not be. So I think that's going to be the big question, is whether or not on the defensive end, these guys can switch. And then you could see a game where it doesn't become against fading the big man anymore. It comes against fading a one-dimensional. If you get these big men who can do everything, like some of the prospects we've seen this year, they could be even more valuable than a wing.
What I also see as something happening is that, you know, teams don't really attack that mismatch every time, whether it be because they want to distribute the touches evenly or they don't think that that's, like, the proper way to play basketball. But, like, if you have prime Dwight Howard out there against the Warriors, like, yes, Draymond, good defender, great defender even. Draymond is, like, drawing dead to consistently stop, you know, prime 6'11", so strong Dwight Howard or Shaq or whoever. Like, he's just not quite big enough, not quite strong enough to either not foul or limit that to, like, under 1 point per possession. But teams don't do that. They don't attack that big to small mismatch as much as they should. And I kind of think that's partially to blame for the homogenization, is that you don't really take advantage of that mismatch when you get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw this year in the Rockets-Warriors series that, and it'll be interesting to see if Boogie Cousins can actually get back to form, because he would be that's when you're using him, basically.
Yeah.
As you're saying, I mean, he could shoot the three, so he helps with spacing and things like that.
You're putting him out there when the Rockets have PJ Tucker as the center, and you're saying, just get after it.
I mean, the PJ Tucker at center, according to a lot of metrics, was their best lineup. Was the Rockets best? Was their Rockets best lineup? So yeah, so there would be that situation where you looked and they legitimately struggled offensively, like I've never seen before in that Rockets series. I mean, of course they went through bursts and then they buried him a few times. But that would be your counter essentially to the switching defense, is to have a guy who can post. The problem is most teams aren't as good at switching as the Rockets are, so your benefit of posting is not going to be as great. So I just don't know if having a bunch of guys stand around while one guy is in the post is going to work for most teams, just because it's not going to be like a counter to something like the Rockets were presenting. You're probably going to be able to just ball movement and shoot threes and do better than that against most defenses anyway.
What's your prediction of when the Warriors dynasty runs out? When does the run end for you?
Well, I think Draymond and Durant, somebody is going to be gone after, you know, after the season, probably. I mean, we'll see.
I believe both Klay and Draymond will be unrestricted free agents either this year or next year.
I mean, Klay coming, Dre the year after that. So Draymond's probably, I mean, and then Durant, of course, is a, you know,
whatever team pays Draymond is going to hate that contract so hard. Yeah. Not that he's not worth it.
But yeah, he's an enhancer, right? So he enhances.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, but he's enhancing the talent around him as opposed to necessarily being a great. I mean, he creates opportunities, but if your teammates can't take advantage of those opportunities, then on the offensive end, then it's more difficult. So Draymond does not sound like he's going to continue. So I mean, I'd love for Durant to leave, because I feel like
he's by the way, Durant lock leaves after this contract is up. I would bet good money that he's out after this contract.
So I mean, I would love that just because I feel like even Warriors fans might like that a little bit. I mean,
they don't like him. It's Steph's thing, man. The Warriors. Do you follow Ethan Sherwood Strauss on Twitter?
Yeah.
So like he harps on that, and they talk about it on his podcast. Like the Warriors fans are just like, yeah, whatever. Thanks for the championships, dude. But they get mad at him for like winning the Finals MVP over Steph and stuff. Like, I mean, they don't even like him.
I mean, imagine how much fun these last couple of years would have been if Durant was someplace else and you still had this Warriors team. You know, this is the Warriors team.
If Oklahoma City was actually good and competitive and the Warriors were too.
Yeah, well, even if Durant went someplace else and made some other team great. I mean, I just think it would have been that much better. But anyway, so I think the Warriors have another year for sure. After that, I feel like in the year after next is going to be the time where it could finally come to an end. And, you know, I'm not a Warriors ruin the NBA guy, but I also think that people underplay how dominant they are. I mean, I know we had a game 7, but if you look, I looked just at off-season money line to win the championship.
Yeah, I'm actually very interested in this. I wondered.
So if you look at the Warriors, for the last couple of years, they've been around minus 185. So that gives them an implied win probability of about 65% to win the championship. So people will say like, oh, you know, the Lakers and the Celtics won every championship in the 80s. Yeah, that's true. Or even the Lakers won chips. But, you know, prior to the Warriors a few years ago, all the teams were implied win probability of 30, 40%. Mm-hmm. Even the Chicago Bulls following their 72 win season, their implied win probability was slightly lower. So, I mean, I agree that this is not a wholly new phenomenon of there being like a great dominant team or a couple great dominant teams. But if you look at the level at which the certainty we have that the Warriors will win the championship, it really is unprecedented. And it's higher than, you know, what most people consider the greatest team of all time. So I think you can make both arguments. Whether they're not ruining the NBA because people like marginal fans, you're going to gain marginal fans because they love great teams. But at the same time, there is a legitimate argument that there's less competitiveness now than there has been in a while.
Yeah. And I mean, part of that too, is just like the cap dynamics that exist now that like truly kills the small market teams in a way that they weren't dead in the 80s and 90s. Like you could build a decent team in Indiana in 1993. You just would never do that now. It's just not a thing.
I mean, like I said, I really don't like people that harp too much on Durant, but it really is unprecedented going to a 73.
It is. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened.
You can compare what LeBron did when he brought in Wade and Bosch, and we probably were way too optimistic about what those players would be able to do with each other, but it was a blank slate that they were starting from scratch. I mean, this is just basically adding on to what we already knew was good. They clearly all fit together. I mean, it really is something that's unprecedented. So I think it'll be good to shake things up a bit, but it's no surprise that the NBA continues on its trend of continuing to grow as a sport because it just has a lot of things in its favor regardless.
So while we're here on the NBA, I wanted to talk to you about Showdown, which I love. I think a lot of people in the daily fantasy world are not a fan of it because like clearly it's great for the sites. Like they churn a bunch of rake, you know, people are not good at it. I would say 95% of people approach Showdown slates the wrong way. And they're just like, they're just trading money back and forth and the sites are the ones winning. But you posted these really strong, you know, analytical statistical evaluations of the Showdown games for the finals. And probably before I can't claim to have gone all the way back and looked, but my question for you is kind of, what is your opinion overall about Showdown? And do you see there being an edge in basketball specifically and potentially for NFL, and kind of just what's your opinion about it in the daily fantasy space?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it develops. So, you know, it's a one game slate.
I guess they have it on FanDuel too. They just don't call it Showdown.
They definitely had it on FanDuel. So I've better access to DraftKings data going back. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to look at it easier. I mean, the thing is, it's going to be interesting to see how the whole industry shakes out with sports betting coming into play because, you know, sports betting is just so much easier.
So much easier. Like I'm telling you, man, all the content, all the good stuff you see on Twitter, it's going to like 2 years from now, it's going to look totally different because everyone's just going to be talking about betting because the analysis is easier and it's so much easier to play.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see what the level of quality of the analysis is going to be pretty ugly.
Oh, it's going to be quite bad.
so, I mean, but DFS does lend itself to a more analytical analysis because it's very complicated. And yeah. I think we've seen through those who were able to dominate, mostly because they really, I feel like they really understand the ownership and how to use those things, which most people probably aren't even thinking about. But anyway, when you're talking about these single game showdown slates, I think there's initially a very high advantage to playing them because people don't know how to play them. I think once techniques become more popular, a little bit less so in basketball, but I know I looked at the MLB and the MLB was really interesting because using relief pitchers ended up being
That's like a big edge, is like figuring out which relief pitcher is going to get in.
Yeah, I mean, but most people just aren't thinking when they're, because traditionally you're not using relief pitchers in your DFS lineup. So it's kind of an outside of the box sort of thing. And not only what we're talking about using one relief pitcher, you know, a lot of the things I was looking at was using both starting pitchers, you know, both starting pitchers and two relief pitchers. So using a lot of different guys there. So I feel like there's a huge edge. Once people start to learn that, there's probably less of an edge. I mean, you got an issue with splitting near the top of these contests, which ends up bringing things down. But I think generally there will be it's going to be better than sports betting as far as your ability to win, because you're not playing against the book. You're playing against another player who's not going to be as sophisticated. So there's always going to be an intrigue there. And those are just the contests that are going to grow, because especially in contrast to sports betting, I just don't know what percentage of the betting public or the sports fan public is going to want to put the effort it is to put a full slate salary cap contest and all that goes into it, and all the tracking you have to do and all the adjusting that you have to do. It's just going to be very difficult to figure out how big those are going to be able to grow, where your marginal person who doesn't want to put in that much effort is going to say, you know what, I like the Niners this week.
Yep. I like Showdown for that reason, is like I can jump into something and just research these two teams and like kind of just use overall fantasy sports knowledge and apply it to that. And the more niche it gets, the softer it gets. Like probably my greatest ROI in the entire time I've been playing DFS is MLS soccer Showdown slates, just because like people are bad. You just grant that in general, people are bad at fantasy. So like 50% of your opponents are just going to be doing things that leave you drawing dead. But in Showdown, if you make one bad play, you're like super drawing dead because everything is exacerbated. Like you're getting twice the points for everything. So you're really just getting wrecked for one bad decision in Showdown, which I kind of like.
I mean, a lot of these things are just about being ahead of the curve, right? So the guys mm-hmm. who are making money in DFS, even in NFL or NBA 5 years ago, would get destroyed today, right? Because they
were... Yeah, me. I was good. I was real good 5 years ago.
Because they were just ahead of the curve versus vis-a-vis their opponent. So I think like when you introduce something new like a Showdown, it gives you the opportunity to be ahead of the curve. At the same time, you know, eventually the IBM Watson is just going to be winning everyone's money. So it doesn't really matter in a lot of these contests.
Yeah. So before we get out of here, we got to talk Bitcoin, because you told me on Twitter that you're a no coiner. So I want to give you the floor for your stance on Bitcoin and actually all coins in general, because I do think they're two different things. And you mentioned you come from finance, so I'm expecting a well-reasoned and educated take here.
Well, okay, I don't really follow the debate to a great degree, so I'm not sure. Going to get into specifics or things like that. But I'll tell you that, I mean, number one, a little historical perspective here. I remember first seeing Bitcoin back in, I remember distinctly like Thanksgiving time, 2010. So this will give you a frame of reference on my opinion. Cause I remember at that point in time, I don't know what it was.
That was pretty early on. That was before I knew about it.
It was probably less than a dollar at that point. And yeah. I was already, you know, tracking its exponential growth over the last year or something like that. I was already like, oh, this thing is, you know, it's a bust. So that gives you a little perspective on where things may go going forward. But the whole thing against it comes down to how do you even value it, right? So how do we even place a value on something where its value is only based upon the value that we're placing on it. So that's kind of number one. I don't know how you do a reasonable argument for whether Bitcoin is worth
the value of the value of all money. The value, I will refute that now by just saying the value of all money is whatever someone agrees that it is. For something to be valuable, multiple parties have to agree upon its value, which is what we all do with USD. It's what we all do with euros. It's what we all do with gold. We just all agree that it has that value, but nothing has inherent value.
Well, like, I mean, the dollar has inherent value because you get arrested. I mean, because the government has made it its currency, right?
But we just all agree to use this system.
There are supply and demand dynamics. You know, there are supply and demand dynamics behind these other things. I mean, there are with Bitcoin too, mm-hmm. right? Like, its limited supply is one of its, but its value is clearly not based upon demand for using it as an actual currency, which I think a lot of it, when you're looking at fiat currencies, I mean, that's what the demand is, just based upon people.
But there, so my argument to that is there's no free market for money. You whatever money you use is whatever money the country you live in uses. You don't get to decide what you want to use for money, because it's just what is there.
Yeah, no. Obviously, that gives it a big. But you can trade. I mean, you can trade currencies and things like that. Mm-hmm. So no, I agree with all that. It's just, you know, whether Bitcoin is $1,000 or $10,000 or $5 or something like that, I just feel like something where its value as a speculative investment is probably 1,000x its value as a currency or as a medium of exchange. I don't know how you value something like that, or how you get overly optimistic about the prospects for the future until that ratio starts to change a bit. I mean, once it really is being used, and I feel like there has to be some sort of stability and value is going to help it being used too. I mean, anyone who bought a piece of pizza with Bitcoin 3 years ago is probably kicking themselves for having spent.
I've kicked myself many a time.
So if you don't even want to spend something, then I don't. It makes it a little bit more difficult to see as.
But you wouldn't want to spend gold if you owned gold, right? It's not like you're not going out. You're not carrying bullion cubes and, like, you know, using it to buy your cup of coffee.
Well, they also had a fixed exchange rate for. I mean, there's also, when you had gold in the past, you would have a currency and then you'd fix it to it or something like that. So you wouldn't be as concerned about doing something like that. But yeah, I mean, I just feel like if it gets picked up in the market more and it's being used more, then that would be one thing. But another thing is, like, governments will just, you know, they'll never let it be such a dominant form of exchange anyway. And as long as you have that power, it's very difficult to see anything growing outside of it.
So my main thing would be, the government could say it's, like, unlawful to own Bitcoin, but they certainly could never take it from you if you didn't give them your private key. So, like, you could keep it forever and you could leave the country or sell it to someone else who lives in a different country. So that's always a possibility.
But what value does it have if you can't use it, I guess?
Well, like, the people in Venezuela, they use it to, like, keep their government from stealing all their money, because, like, their government's currently fracturing around right now.
I agree. If you're Venezuela, you're fine. But then, you know, every place has to be Venezuela. So that's, you know, I'm sure some people think that's going to happen in the United States or something like that. But I think that's, you know, it's far away from being a possibility at any time in the future.
My deal is, I want to keep as little of my value in US dollars as I can. I have gold, I have crypto, I want to have money invested, because the US dollar just craters in value. You know, every 10 years it's just like getting wrecked, because our government prints so much and it's getting inflated so much. And Bitcoin not only has operated as a store of value, obviously it's not operating as a great store of value if you bought it at 20k, but if you bought it at 6k, like, you're fine right now. I would say a majority, or at least a plurality of people who have invested in Bitcoin or own Bitcoin, have had a successful and positive experience with it. The people that are bummed out about Bitcoin are the people who bought it after Thanksgiving 2017.
Like, I mean, I'm all for investing. I'm all for investing. I'm all for not keeping your money just sitting in a bank, because that's just absurd, obviously.
Yeah.
Beyond funds that you may need access to in the near future. So I'm all for that. I feel like Bitcoin is just, it's so highly speculative that it's fine if you want to allocate a small portion to it, but anything that's being ascribed to it for bigger things, it's just very difficult to say what the correct price is on something that it's just all based upon what someone else is willing to pay for it, essentially.
Well, I'm not one of these people, but like a real Bitcoin maximalist would tell you its value in US dollars means nothing because eventually all transactions will just take place in Bitcoin or whatever, which I don't actually believe. I believe that the real value in Bitcoin, and I own other cryptocurrencies, but only speculatively, only in terms of an investment, but I'll never sell my Bitcoin just because I believe sort of philosophically in it overall.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's an element of like how you think about these things, which I think even comes into it. There's a type of thinking called Bayesian inference, where you basically have a prior and then you have evidence and then you kind of have a new thinking. Now, some of this comes into play with a lot of theories people have. And I think when it comes into Bitcoin, I think this goes come to play. So your prior is kind of the way that the existing currency system works, how stable it really is, who's really invested in it, how many people. And then you know, your evidence can be all these amazing things you think Bitcoin is going to do and the way that it can work and you know, the things that can happen to the monetary system and the world and everything else like that. But the prior is like so strong that even if you have really great evidence here, it should only move your thinking marginally. So if you want to have a marginal movement of your thinking, I just wouldn't buy in 100% into the theories for what's possible just because there's like this such strong evidence that it's going to be a very niche thing and there's such power behind just keeping the way things are.
That's a great way to end your appearance on the TakeCast, my man. Good life advice, good advice on Bitcoin. Tell the people where they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at Cole_Kev, as you mentioned, Director of Data and Analytics at RotoGrinder. So especially coming into NFL season, which is really more my thing than anything else, the projections are going to be powered by stuff that I'm doing, but I'm also going to try to get a lot more content out there for DFS and also for sports betting. So be on the lookout.
There we go. Everyone, I'd like to thank you so much for listening to the episode with Kevin. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Make sure to check out his work on rotogrinders.com and Fantasy Insiders. Give me a follow on Twitter at DavisMatic, and please leave a rating and review on iTunes. Hopefully be back later this week with another stellar episode. Until then, take it easy, everybody.